what you said about Arlene, because it's going to tie in with the sermon. Yeah, hopefully you can figure it out if I forget to mention it. Okay, I got to wear my glasses because I got my New American Standard Bible here, which has smaller print than my other one, which I have trouble with the other one, but I definitely won't be able to read this one. Did I want to say anything else? I don't think so. There's an interesting account of a paralytic being healed by Jesus. It's found in Luke 5, Mark 2, and Matthew 9. And I wanted to talk about that, and I didn't look up on the sermon list, but have we had a sermon recently, or do you remember one specifically on that incident where they lowered the paralytic through the roof? You remember hearing about that? Good. Even if you did, I'm going to cover more than that, because the way it turns out that I thought it would be best understood as I was doing the research for the sermon, I thought it would be best understood if we did a whole chapter and showed how it all tied together rather than just deal with that. So if you'd like, you can give this sermon a title, very unimaginative title, of Luke 5. That's where we're going to spend the whole sermon in Luke 5. Just a couple of times go look at something else, but we're going to look at Luke chapter 5. And I've been preaching a lot from Luke, later on in the travel narrative. This is before that. This is when Jesus' ministry was first starting up in the Galilee. I forgot to bring my dry erase marker. I was going to draw you a picture on the map, and I forgot. Or I'm just going to draw you a map on the board. But give me a second. Yeah. Don't see anything. Doesn't matter. I've shown you enough pictures over enough years of the Sea of Galilee and so forth. But we're going to do Luke 5, but first let's just take a quick look at Luke 1, 2, and 3, and 4, just to get an idea of where we are and what Luke's doing. And you can remember, at least my perspective, you may not all agree, but I think that Luke in particular and the other gospel writers put things together thematically. They organize the events in Jesus' life in an order that made the points they wanted to make to their audience, not necessarily in an exact order of when things happened. I don't think that matters. I don't have a problem looking at it that way, but that's kind of what I believe. Obviously, in some cases, it is chronological. I mean, that's, you know, the first chapter talks about John the Baptist, and second chapter talks about Jesus' birth and all this kind of thing. Those are obviously in order. But at the same time, Luke in particular, I think, organizes his information in ways that make a point. He's, you know, when he has a particular, he didn't write in chapters. You understand that in the Greek, it's just all capital letters, no breaks. I don't know how in the world you could read that kind of way, but I guess if you're used to that, you could. But he wrote in blocks of text that had to do, in my opinion, and opinion of scholars, some scholars, most scholars. He wrote in a way that things that went together to prove a point, he put those things in a particular storyline so that they support one another. I think that's the case with chapter 5, and I'll be talking from that perspective. In chapter 1, we have the story of John the Baptist. In chapter 2, we've got the birth narrative of Jesus. Chapter 3 goes back to John. Chapter 1's more about John the Baptist's birth, and then what they call the Magnificat, when Mary visited Elizabeth, and that prophecy there. And then we get to chapter 3, where John the Baptist is actually preaching. He baptizes Jesus. They have the genealogy at the end of chapter 3. So this is all material to set up the gospel. And we also have to remember, if you want to look at it, Luke chapter 1 and verse 1, it says, Here's the way Luke introduces his gospel, and this matters. And we don't want to forget it as we read the gospel. Inasmuch, I've got the New American Standard. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us. That's verse 1. Now, I'll interrupt myself right there. Luke's saying, you know, he's not the first one to try to write this down. All right, he's not the first one. And remember, he was not an eyewitness. Nor was he an eyewitness to the first part of the book of Acts until he teamed up with Paul and was traveling around with him. So he's writing a history in a sense, but he's relying on other sources. It certainly seems like Mark is one of those sources, but there were others as well. Verse 2, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses, he wasn't, right, and servants of the word. It seemed fitting for me as well, having investigated everything carefully, so I wasn't there, but I've done the gumshoe work, I've done my investigation, to write it out for you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the teachings you have been taught. So 2 points there. One is that this guy's name is Theophilus. I don't know where he lived or whatever. He's got a Greek name. He's a Roman. You know, he's a Roman with a Greek name. He lives somewhere else. And Luke is explaining what happened in Jesus' life for the benefit of Theophilus. And then he's got the second account, Acts, which is what the apostles were doing. He's explaining. It also says here, and I'm reading from the King James, I mean from the New American Standard, I've written it out for you in consecutive order. Okay, I'm saying I don't think he did that exactly. Well, in general, he's writing from the beginning to the end of Jesus' life. I just don't believe that he's saying that, the story that's in our chapter 10 necessarily happened the day before the story that's in chapter 11. I don't think he's being that specific about consecutive order. He's writing many years later, and he wasn't even there. So he's relying on what other people have said, and these are the things that Jesus did during his life, and he's got it pretty much in order of Jesus' life, but I don't think the day-to-day order is necessarily preserved, nor that it needs to be, or that it matters in any kind of way. All right. The fact that he's writing to this Greek guy, Theophilus, matters in terms of what he says and how he says it. And we'll see an example of that in Luke chapter 5. And I hadn't thought about it before. But I'll just mention it now. It's like if you're depending on who you are talking to, you say things differently. When I go to Thailand, I simplify allusions to things that would be familiar to you but not to them. Or I don't even make those allusions. I try to make the point without saying things that I have to explain more thoroughly. I'm sure you have done that on occasion. I didn't come up with a good example, but there are times when to explain the details of something would take you 5 minutes, when really you only have a 10-second point you want to make. And so you don't say exactly the right thing, or you don't say exactly the right word, because you don't want to bother explaining why you've approximated it rather than giving the exact detail. I can't explain that any better when we get into the story of the paralytic. You'll see why I'm mentioning that, but I'll say it up front. Sometimes we want to say things in a way that will be understood by the person we're talking to, and we don't give them every single detail because it's not familiar to them, and then we end up lengthening the story by making it 2, 3, 4, 5 times as long, and they lose the point of what it is we're trying to make. Okay, Luke chapter 4, we have the temptation, quote-unquote the temptation, and that's important in its order. For a reason I don't want to mention yet, but Jesus' public ministry begins in the Galilee. Remember Galilee, the Sea of Galilee is up in the north. It's a separate Roman province. You've got Galilee, then you've got Samaria, and south of that you've got Judea, which is where Jerusalem is. And I've shown you that so many times, I guess it's in your head now, or it's in the back of your Bible in a map there. Jesus' public ministry started in the Galilee, which is up by that lake. And there were a lot of fishermen. That was the way a lot of people made their living, on the lake there. His ministry began with healings, with exorcisms, with big crowds, public recognition because of these miracles. And Luke includes the temptation of Jesus, if you want to call it that, the testing by the devil. He includes that both chronologically, because it happened there at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, but also for another reason, because Jesus handled the testing. And it is in line with what Luke is going to do in chapter 5 and beyond, where he is going to focus on Jesus' authority to do what it was he was doing. Okay, and that was always a question. When the Pharisees, the Sadducees, all the other C's, the scribes, whoever else, when they're coming around, what they had an issue with more often than not was, who gave you the authority to do all this? Who gave you the authority? And he never answered them directly, not usually anyway. He had that one answer that one time. He says, tell me, was the baptism of John, what did he say? I forget how he says it. But was that of man or of God? and they couldn't answer it because either way there was it was a no-win situation for the people that had asked him the question, the initial question. And then when they wouldn't answer his, he said, well, I won't answer yours. By what authority I do this? But that's always been a concern to people. Like, who gave you the right to you know, fill in the blank? And I've had that of me. You know, my own personal example, my own personal experiences in the church. You know, somebody in authority said, well, who gave you the authority? How do you get to do what you do? And I wasn't smart enough at the time to say, all right, it's the baptism. I would have said something differently. I would have said, with the ordination that we had in world, why was that of God or of men? And he wouldn't have been able to answer that either way. And I would have been able to say, like, Jesus, I'm not going to answer you either. But I wasn't smart enough to think of it at the time. I can't relive that. But it's always been an issue. It's always been an issue because people want to hold on to their authority that they think they have. And at the time of Jesus, it was the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Sadducees had their control of the temple and all the rights associated with it and the money that passed through. The Pharisees had the respect of the people, and they were the teachers. They were the ones who ran the schools and trained the young people. And they were respected for that because they knew the law, the teachers among them. And the Sanhedrin, the ruling court of the Jewish society, was made up of both Sadducees and Pharisees. Remember when Paul had to appear before them, and he realized that some of them were Sadducees and some of them were Pharisees. He said, I've been dragged into this court because of the resurrection of the dead. And the Pharisees believe in that. The Sadducees didn't. Then they get in an argument and they forget about Paul altogether because they can't, without causing a problem among themselves, they can't really agree on how they would deal with Paul. So he worked that division. My point is, all of these people were involved in the ruling elite of the Jews at the time. And they all had authority that was given to them, not necessarily by God, although God, you know, allows that, but by the governments, the Maccabean governments, where they, there's a name for those people, that right now slips in my mind. But they gave the, you know, they were the ones that chose, the governments chose the high priests and so forth. So they all worked together. Hasmonean governments that were the rulers of the Jews underneath the Romans. The authority was granted from them at this time. They were the ones. And I forget her name, but there's some woman that gave more power to the Pharisees, some maybe a couple hundred years before Jesus' time. So it wasn't just the temple elite that had power, but also the Pharisees did. And they kind of had a power-sharing thing going. Each had their own spheres of influence. So Luke is writing in a way that's going to establish Jesus' authority. And he begins by, well, in Luke 3, he's got the genealogy that shows, all right, he's qualified to be who he is, the Messiah. He's been prophesied, and some of those details are in Luke 1 and 2. And then in Luke 4, we've got where he takes on the devil, and he's successful there with the help of his father, obviously. And therefore, he does have authority. And then he begins to demonstrate that authority by healing people, by casting out demons and so forth. And because of that, I mean, it's a good deal, right? You get healed, you're sick. So people were coming to him to get healed. So word was spreading that this man was different, that he really could heal. He taught in a way that the masses liked. And he was, you know, attention was beginning to spread. The word was spreading and people were coming. And eventually, of course, the leading lights in the community, the Pharisees, Sadducees, even from down south from Judea, said, here's this guy. He's healing people. He's preaching. He must be something. We better go check him out. At that time, he was just preaching up in Galilee. He was preaching in the cities along the coast of you got the Sea of Galilee and the northwest coast, you know, Capernaum, Bethsaida, Chorazin, these towns up here. That's where he was preaching. And that area itself had a name. Oh, we'll get there in a minute. The same name as the lake. So we get to Luke chapter 5 finally. I just want to give you the context first. And I'll start reading here. It says, and I'm again, New American Standard. Now it happened that while the crowd was pressing around him and listening to the word of God, he was standing by the lake of Gennesaret. Verse one says. Well, that's another name for the Sea of Galilee. Okay? And it's also a name for this arc around the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee. If you could say this area was called Gennesaret, as well as the lake called Gennesaret. Not the whole around, but just up here. And that's where Capernaum was. Capernaum, if you remember, is where Peter lived and where his mother's house was. So there's a lot of people. They were pressing. It's all like they're pushing him into the lake. There's so many people. And he sees a couple of empty boats, it says, lying at the edge of the lake. The fishermen had gotten out of them and were washing their nets. They tended to fish at night in the deep part, maybe in the shallow part, a little bit in the day, and then they would clean up in the hot heat of the day. That wasn't a good time to fish. So Jesus is preaching at that time, sees the empty boats, and he says he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little way from the land. And he sat down and began teaching people from the boat. So it makes use of the boat to get away from everybody a little bit, plus the sound will travel over the water very clearly. So he takes advantage of that. So this Gennesaret is another name for the Sea of Galilee. In the Old Testament, it's called Kinnereth, which it would be in the Hebrew. So it's as if the crowd was pushing at him a little bit. These fishermen were his friends. He didn't just take a random boat. He knew Simon. You know, he knew the others. These were people that he'd grown up with, people that he knew, and had a relationship with. Verse 4. When he had finished speaking, he said to Simon, "Put out in deep water and let down your nets for a catch." And Simon said, and it doesn't say, but he probably rolled his eyes. He said, "Master," so there was a certain respect there. They looked at Jesus as a teacher. He said, "Master, we worked hard all night and caught nothing, but I'll do what you said." So he didn't believe that there'd be any point in doing that, and he should know. He's a fisherman, and you know, his father was probably a fisherman, and his grandfather was probably a fisherman. And if anybody knew the Sea of Galilee and that particular coast, it was Peter and those other fishermen. They knew, and they knew there weren't any fish there. They'd been trying all night. Nobody catches fish at this time of day. So the request was unusual. Jesus' request was unusual, but all right, I'll do it. I'll do what you say. And when they had done this, they enclosed a great quantity of fish, and their nets began to break. So they signaled to their partners in the other boat to come out and help them, and they came and filled both the boats so much that they began to sink. So they had some partners. You know, you have your own boat. Your friends have another boat, and you kind of work together, split the profit or whatever. It identifies them here in a minute. When Simon Peter saw that, he fell down at Jesus' feet and he said, "Go away from me, Lord, for I'm a sinful man." Now, what's that mean? I mean, that's an expression. It doesn't mean that he didn't want Jesus to be there. He just saying, "You know, I'm a sinner. You know, I don't belong to be around you. You just made this happen. I've worked this my whole life. My father worked it before me. My grandfather worked it before him. This doesn't happen. This is a miracle. I can see it's a miracle. I'm a sinner. You know, I don't really belong in the same boat with you." Or in the same room with you. That's the point of what he's saying. He's not saying he doesn't like Jesus and wants him to leave. For amazement, verse 9, had seized him and all of his companions because of the catch of fish they had taken. And so also, you know, also amazed were James and John. They were the partners, the sons of Zebedee. They were partners with Simon. And for some reason, I don't know if Luke didn't like him or what the deal was, but he didn't mention Andrew. Andrew was worked with Peter and James and John were the partners. We know from other gospels that Andrew was there. Just doesn't mention him by name. And Jesus said to Simon, "Don't fear. You know, don't worry about it. I don't need to leave. I'm okay. It's okay. From now on, you will be catching men." And then when they had brought their boats to land, they left everything and followed him. So here, going along with what I'm saying about Luke establishing authority, Luke is going not only establishing Jesus' authority, but he's establishing the authority of the apostles that he's going to write about in the book of Acts. And here, you know, he's going through, this is how Simon and Andrew and James and John were chosen. You know, that Jesus chose them in this particular way. And at this time, so this was the official call. Jesus already knew these people. But now he's saying, you know, it's time. We have a mission here, and you need to stop fishing and join me in this mission full time. And it says in all the Gospels, that's what they did. They stopped. You know, I guess they had other people that could do the fishing, and they followed Jesus. So Luke is introducing the apostles that he's going to write about later in Acts. He's also establishing Jesus' authority, and by extension, he's establishing the apostles' authority, or beginning to establish their authority. Now, we continue on here in the chapter. Get to verse 12, and it says, while he was in one of the cities, doesn't say which one here, behold, there was a man, I assume it's one of these ones on the northwest coast of the Sea of Galilee, maybe Capernaum, we don't know. Behold, there was a man covered with leprosy. And when he saw Jesus, he fell on his face and implored him, saying, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. That's an interesting thing. And you don't think about it maybe when you just read through it. I never thought about it before. But, you know, if you had leprosy, and leprosy doesn't mean what we call leprosy today necessarily. It was just a word that could be used of any skin disease, like an uncontrollable skin disease or something. But he didn't say, you could heal me of this if you want to. At least that's not the way Luke wrote it. He wrote, you can make me clean. Why would he write it like that? Why would that man say that? If you had leprosy, then, maybe even now, you know, in some parts of the world, you are considered unclean, right? You can't touch a leper, you're ceremonially unclean. All right, I've heard this before. I didn't do the research this time, but in at least some communities, maybe it was back here in Judea and Galilee, if you were a leper, or a bunch of you, you know, walking down the street, you had to cry out, you know, leper, leper, to warn people to get away from you. This is the life you lived. You were an outsider. You were what's the right word? You were an outcast from society. You couldn't serve anywhere. You couldn't get near the temple. Certainly couldn't work there. You were an outcast, and you were always an outcast from whatever time you had this disease. And you were a kind of person that people avoided. Now, can you imagine that? You know, we're very conscious in our society. You know, we've got the Americans with Disabilities Act. We've got these laws that try to be more inclusive of people with disabilities than it was when some of us that are older were youngsters. Our society wasn't as inclusive. Now we are, more so. But some societies aren't like that in the world, and this society wasn't like that. So imagine this person with the leprosy. He had whatever. He may have had it since he was very, very young. We don't know. But he was an outcast. He was looked down on. He was avoided. People went to the other, you know, in effect, they went to the other side of the street to avoid having to interact with him. So he said, you can make me clean. And by that, you know, so in his mind, apparently, and in Luke's mind writing this, the real horror here is not that he has a physical disability of some sort by having leprosy, but the connotation, what comes with that, that he is just shunned by all of society. That is the bigger thing. He says, you know, Lord, you can cleanse me. You can cleanse me. You can make me clean. You can make me be like everybody else. That involves healing too, but it seems like the primary concern is make me like everybody else. Make me be able to interact with my friends. Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, I am willing, be cleansed. And immediately the leprosy left him. And that's a reversal. You know, what happens? The whole idea of clean and unclean in the Old Testament is that does clean make unclean clean? Is that the way it works? Did that make sense? Ray's going, huh? What did you just say? You know, can I make something that's dirty clean by touching it? No, it makes me dirty. That's the way it works. And in this way that the laws worked in the Old Testament too, that if you are ceremonially clean, you touch something that's ceremonially unclean, you become unclean. I can't say all these words. That's why, and I was reminded this again when I go past the little airport. We couldn't land at the little airport. We land at the big airport in St. Lucia. We got to drive for an hour and a half to get to where we're going. But there's a little airport that's a lot closer. And I think I've shown you pictures of this. Maybe not. I know I've shown it down there. There's a graveyard right next to the airport, right next to the runway. So if you land there, and I have landed there in the spring, And you land there, and for some reason they whitewash the tombs around Easter. It's a tradition they have. Well, guess what? It was a tradition in Jesus' day too. Only it wasn't Easter, it was Passover. Why did they whitewash them? They whitewashed the tomb so that while you were traveling to Jerusalem to keep the Passover and you were ceremonially clean, you wouldn't just sit down and rest on a tomb because you didn't know it was a tomb. You just thought it was a rock there or something. You could sit down, or you might touch it, or you might lean on it. So they would whitewash them so you knew where they were so that you wouldn't make yourself unclean. Because you're not going to make the tomb clean by touching it. It's going to make you unclean. So Jesus reverses that right here. He touches the unclean thing, makes it clean. Okay? That's this book here I've got sitting on the desk, a guy named Doug Greenwald. He likes to talk about Jesus' mission as rescuing. That's what he does. He rescues and restores. I'll mention that later. But, you know, Jesus rescues this man, restores. He's able to clean by touching. It doesn't work the other way with Jesus. So that's a wonderful thing. So the defilement doesn't work in the direction you think it's going to work. He ordered him in verse 14 not to tell anyone, but go and show yourself to the priest and make an offering for your cleansing, just as Moses commanded, as a testimony to them. Okay, so the word's already out among the community that Jesus is a healer, right? But now, for two reasons, I think. One is because it was Moses commanded it. There, you weren't clean until, even if you got better, if you were a leprous, had a skin disease, you weren't officially clean until you went to the temple, or the tabernacle, whatever they had at the time. Now they had a temple. You went to the temple, presented yourself to the priest, they would make a special offering, and maybe some washings, I don't remember, and then you were ceremonially clean. And Jesus said, go and do this. You know, Jesus healed him, or God through Jesus healed him, and he was clean. He was clean in that sense, but he wasn't ceremonially clean until he went through the procedure. And Jesus told him to go ahead and do that. So this shows Jesus' support for the laws that having to do with the temple. But the other thing it shows you, excuse me, is that Jesus was ready to witness to the leaders. At this point, he's ready to, you know, go tell the priests. You know, you don't tell anybody else. Of course, he did. But, you know, don't tell anybody else, but you can go and do this, what you're supposed to do at the temple. I guess he had to go all the way to Jerusalem. I don't know what the deal was. This is up near Galilee. But at some point, next time he went to Jerusalem, he would have to go through this ritual. So Jesus was ready for the priests, you know, the temple establishment, to hear in an official way that he was on the scene, knowing that this was going to cause him some trouble eventually. But the news about him was spreading, verse 15, even further, and large crowds were gathering to hear him and to be healed of their sicknesses. Of course, you know, if you go get healed, it'd be a big crowd. But Jesus himself would often slip away to the wilderness and pray. So he had to kind of get away from everybody just to have some time to himself or some time with his Father. So the fame was spreading. All right, this is all in the background. All right, Jesus establishing, or Luke is establishing Jesus' authority to do what he's doing. Jesus has healed somebody, sent him to the priest, and said, you know, go ahead and do your sacrifice and so forth. So the witness is there. He's, you know, you can be a witness to the priest. And now we get to verse 17. One day he was teaching. There were some Pharisees and teachers of the law sitting there who had come from every village in Galilee and Judea and from Jerusalem. Now, that's not literally true. They weren't there from every village. But the point is, they would come from all over because Jesus' fame was spreading. And these people were coming from all around to see if Jesus was the real deal. The idea that there was going to be a Messiah, that was something they all knew. There were going to be Messiah. Well, let's go find out if this is the guy. You know, has God authorized this particular individual to be the Messiah? We need to go look at the fruits. And it says in verse 17, this is interesting, again from the New American Standard, the power of the Lord was present for him to perform healing. So it wasn't his power. He was fully human. He was a human being. He didn't have power to heal, but God did, and God delegated that power to him. You know, how that works in detail, I don't know, but it just says here, Luke says he had this power, but he had it because his Father had given him that power. So there were all kind of priests there. There were teachers. I shouldn't say all kind of priests, but there were people sent on behalf of the priests anyway, and the Pharisees. You know who they were, but there were people there to get the scoop on this individual and find out if he was the real deal. Find out, should we think this guy's the Messiah? You know, where does he get his authority? Is God with him? Is God not with him? And maybe they were, you know, utterly sincere at this time, you know, literally looking for a Messiah and wanting to find out. In time, they had it in for Jesus and they wanted to kill him. But that may not have been the case at first. You know, they're looking for a Messiah, so why wouldn't they check him out just like they check anybody else out? So the power of the Lord was with him to heal. You know, is this guy the sign here of the messianic age? Are we just about there? Interesting. Now, it says, and some men were carrying on a bed a man who was paralyzed. All right, there's a couple things here. First of all, a paralytic would be the same as a leprous man in the sense that they would be looked down on, they would be shunned. It's not that you couldn't touch him maybe, but like a leprous person. But in that culture, just as it is in a Hindu culture, when I go to Thailand, if you're disabled in some way, it's kind of like it's your fault, right? You know, what you deserve that, or it's karma. You know, we call it with the Hindus and the Buddhists. It's your karma. You deserve it. That's why you're that way. And you think, well, wait a minute, the Jews aren't that way. But if you look at John 9 and verse 2, you don't have to turn there, I'll just read it. John 9 and verse 1, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he would be born blind? See, it was an automatic assumption in that culture that if you had some kind of a disability like that, there was sin involved. God didn't smile on you. You know, and Jesus didn't support that kind of teaching. But that was the average Joe or the average, whoever they were, the average Shimon, like Peter, you know, you would thought they did something wrong or they wouldn't be this way. If we were to look at Mark 2, and we will later, but not quite this second, there were four men. It says there were four men carrying him. So this paralytic was somebody who was shunned by his culture. All right, he wasn't. You know, something was wrong with him. He was some kind of a sinner, or his parents were, or somebody was, or he wouldn't be in this condition. What's interesting about this, and it comes up in a later verse, is he had four men that were dedicated to him enough to carry him around on this stretcher. Isn't that interesting? Even though the world in general shunned him, he had four really good friends, apparently. It says four men carried him around. This paralytic was used to being excluded, just like those leprous men were used to being excluded. And notice what it says. They were carrying him, they were trying to bring him in and set him down in front of him, that is Jesus. But not finding a way to bring him in because of the crowd, so it was too crowded. They couldn't bring him in to this room. And I say a room, it was probably some, I've shown you pictures of typical Palestinian houses or houses in Jerusalem. This house is probably a little bit different from the way it's described. Some of them, some houses of people that were a little bit better off, I've shown you these little tiny little house, two-story houses that were typical. But in a town sometimes, you may have somebody with a little more means, and they still got these tiny little rooms where they would stay, but they might have a courtyard, or it might be more than one house that where they surround a courtyard. When I say courtyard, it doesn't mean a great big open space, but a somewhat open space, not necessarily open to the sky, but open between the houses where there was room. And so if Jesus was talking in this house, he's not going to be inside the bedroom, which may be something that you can touch both walls if you stretch your hands out. You know, where they just sleep. He's in an open area where you might set up the triclinium and eat, where you might have a meeting, where you might do whatever else. Well, people with more means had houses that had this open area in them, this open space. And there were so many people in this open space that these four guys couldn't even get their paralytic friend in through the door to get near Jesus. But they were entrepreneurial, and they persevered. And in those kind of, in a Palestinian house, as I've shown you before, They had a roof, and they did things on the roof. The roof was strong enough to walk on. It had beams, probably. They used basalt. They used rock basalt. And then they would also have timber beams, and then they'd lay other boards. Then they put mud and maybe some straw or something, and you could walk on top of it. Why? Because in the summer when it's really hot, sometimes the rooms would get really, really hot and uncomfortable, so you could at least eat out on the roof or sit out on the roof, or if you're like David, go out on the roof, you know, look at somebody, look at the women on from the roof, whatever. I mean, you could get on the roof and look around. and enjoy the coolness. Okay, so it was not unusual to be up on your roof and have a roof that you could get to. And how did you get to it? Well, they had stairways on the outside of the house to get to the roof. So these guys can't get in through the main door. And they say, all right, they come up with a plan. They're going to go up the stairs and get on the roof. And somehow they're going to get in the house through the roof. Now, that would take a while. But when you read of how it was then, and it's probably not that much different now, if you, a typical Jewish teacher at the time would talk just as long as anybody wanted to listen. They weren't looking at their watches. They didn't have watches. And as long as there's enough people there to have questions, he'll keep teaching. So they saw this big crowd and said, we got time. We got time. He'll be here for a while. They went upstairs and on the top of the roof. All right. Let's see. Now, verse 19, it says, but not finding a way to bring him in because of the crowd, they went up on the roof and let him down through the tiles with his stretcher into the middle of the crowd in front of Jesus. Now, here's an example through the tiles. They didn't build houses in Capernaum or Jerusalem or anywhere else around there with tiles on the roof. There's no evidence that that's the way they built. But Luke is writing to this Theophilus, and where Theophilus lived, if you were going to get up on the roof and come into the house, you had to remove the tiles. So rather than go into an explanation of how we build houses here and use up, you know, what we would call three or four verses explaining how we build houses, he just said they moved some tiles and came down through the roof, you know, so that Theophilus would understand. But the reality is, they didn't build houses like that, best we can tell. So, and if you read back, and now we'll turn to Mark, or I'll turn to Mark, but we'll come back here in a minute. If you read Mark, you'll see it's a little different. And it just has to do with the audience. And this is where Luke didn't feel like spelling out in detail, because it didn't matter to the story. Didn't feel like spelling out the detail to Theophilus. Mark chapter 2, I'll just read verses 1 to 4 here. When he had come back to Capernaum, it was heard that he was home, and many gathered together, so there was no longer room. So this was Capernaum. I guess it didn't say any other. He was in Capernaum. No longer room, not even near the door. And he was speaking the word to them, and they came, bringing to him a paralytic carried by four men. Being unable to get to him because of the crowd, they removed the roof above him, and when they had dug an opening. This is written by Mark. He's writing to a Palestinian audience, and they understood that to get through the roof, you got to dig a hole. And you didn't have to explain it. They dug an opening. They let down the pallet on which the paralytic was lying. So that's what happened. And Luke doesn't bother to try to explain that to Theophilus, because it's just not worth the ink it would have taken to explain it, and it didn't change the story. Now, verse 20. And this is interesting. And I never noticed this before. You know, you've heard Jesus say before, or you've seen it, and it says, you know, by your faith, you know, I will that you be healed, or something about faith, right? Well, it's the same here, but it's a big difference. He says, Luke wrote this, seeing their faith, he said, friends, your sins are forgiven you. Isn't that interesting? I never caught that before. He didn't say seeing his faith. It doesn't say here, Luke writing it, doesn't say that the guy in the stretcher had any faith at all. He said seeing their faith. These guys believed in Jesus so much, they went to the trouble to go up on the roof and dig a hole and then lower him down. How do you lower somebody down through the roof? I don't know what, did they have some ropes around? I don't know what they did. It's just an amazing thing. Certainly got everybody's attention. But Luke writes, seeing their faith. That's interesting. And he said, friend, your sins are forgiven you. Is that why they brought the man on the stretcher? To have his sins forgiven? What do you think? No, I don't think so. They want him to be healed. It doesn't say what the guy said. Oh, wait a minute, Jesus. Let's be in the wrong line. We want him to be healed. We didn't know this was the forgiveness of sin line. But that's what they got. But there's a purpose. So the scribes and the Pharisees began to reason, saying, who is this man who speaks blasphemies? Why is it a blasphemy? Why did they say that? Why'd they call it a blasphemy?
Only God can forgive sin.
So they seem to be perfectly right here. This guy can't say that. Who is he? He can't forgive. You know, we might have a Messiah here. You know, we might have, you know, but God, only God can forgive sins. This is a blasphemy. Who can forgive sins but God alone? But Jesus, aware of their reasonings, answered and said to them, "Why are you reasoning in your hearts? What's easier to say, 'Your sins have been forgiven you,' or to say, 'Get up and walk'? But so that..." No, I'll just stop there first. See, I hadn't... Until I studied this whole chapter together, this never made sense to me. I never really did. I've read explanations of this, but it never clicked. It's like, how is it that healing somebody shows that you have... Or you can forgive their sins? I didn't get it. I think I get it now. I'll share with you. Well, it says it right here. I just didn't get it. Maybe you always did get it, but I didn't. But, verse 24... "So that you may know that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralytic, "I say to you, get up and pick up your stretcher and go home." So, having the authority, this is the key, which I didn't get before. Having the authority over the disease demonstrated that he also had authority over, not over sin, but that he could forgive sin. Why is that? Well, because... How did he heal? He healed with the power of God. It said that earlier on verse 17, that God had delegated that power to Jesus to heal. He also delegated the authority to forgive sin. All right, that is God's. They were right. Only God can do that. But God could delegate that authority, just like you can delegate authority if you're a boss at work, right? You can delegate authority to somebody else, and then they have it. They don't have it because of who they are. They have it because of who you are. And Jesus had that authority because of who his Father was. And the relationship he had with his Father, and he uses the term Son of Man. Maybe you've heard before, I know Mike has mentioned it in sermons some years ago. There's this term, a Hebrew term called remetz, or something like that. I don't know how you say it. In English, you would spell it R-E-M-E-Z. And it means if you refer to something, in my explanation, if you refer to something, it reminds you of something else. When Jesus said, "Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sin," they know, these Pharisees, they know the Bible inside and out, and they know that he's referring to Daniel 7. And in Daniel 7, it's where it talks about the Ancient of Days, and then the Son of Man appears, right? And I'll just read it. "I kept looking in the night visions, behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man was coming, and he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all people and nations and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed." So Jesus is, in effect, saying, well, yeah, I know, I don't really have the authority to do this on my own, but I'm this one, I am the one that Daniel's talking. Dreaming, you know, had this vision about in Daniel 7. I am the Son of Man. This authority has been delegated to me by my Father. And so, in the context the way I've presented Luke 5, you see this kind of makes sense. It's all about, it's not the only thing it's about, but it has a consistent theme here of authority. Jesus establishing his authority, Jesus making it clear that he's got the authority of his Father behind him, and Luke including all these incidents in the same general area, although he didn't write in chapters, he's including all of these things so that we can see that Luke is making the point that that Jesus is establishing his authority. And also interesting that, you know, they had ways of forgiving sin, just, you know, that were prescribed in the Old Testament. You know, you have a sacrifice, you go to the temple or the tabernacle, and you go through these rituals. And, you know, Jesus is saying, you know, it's my Father that does that, and he can do it in Capernaum. He doesn't need, you know, you don't need to be in Jerusalem. You don't need to sacrifice an animal. I'm going to be the sacrifice. So he's making a point here that forgiveness isn't about all these rituals. God can do it however he wants. And he doesn't need a temple, or he doesn't need the animal sacrifices. Verse 25. "So immediately this guy got up before them, he picked up what he'd been lying on, he went home glorifying God. And they were all struck with astonishment and began glorifying God, and they were filled with fear, saying, 'We have seen remarkable things today.'" Yeah, they'd seen remarkable things. And this man was motivated, and this is where it reminded me of Arlene, this man was motivated that he wanted to share the good news with other people. He was motivated to glorify God and share the news with other people, as were others that had experienced having their sins forgiven. They went and talked about it with other people, shared the gospel with other people. This man received more than he asked for. He went to get healed. He got healed and his sins forgiven. He got a spiritual healing and a physical healing. You know, God, through Jesus, rescued him and restored him. Okay, it's both. Continuing on in the chapter here, just to finish it up. And after that, he went out and noticed a tax collector named Levi sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he left everything behind and got up and began to follow him. All right, obviously Jesus knew Levi. Levi's Matthew. He knew him, and now it was time to become a disciple. You know about tax collectors, right? It's not tax collectors like we have now. They were subcontractors, and they had to collect, you know, I had to collect $10 from Ray and give it to the Romans, right? But I didn't collect $10 from Ray. I collected $10 plus expenses, because I get, you know, cost me money to have to chase Ray down and get that $10. So I'm gonna collect $12 from Ray, or maybe if I don't like him, I'll collect $15 from Ray, and then I'll give the Romans $10. So the people hated the tax collectors because they all ripped people off, right? And they were Jews. That's more reason they were hated. They were like traitors. So. You remember when they went to John the Baptist, and then some of the tax collectors went to John the Baptist, and they said, "What should we do?" He was telling them all to repent. And I said, "Well, I repent of what?" And you know, John the Baptist told the tax collector, what did he tell them? Don't take any more than you're supposed to. Now, I think, you know, a commission was allowed, but you know, don't cheat the people. Don't cheat the people. I mean, they got a salary. Their salary was the extra they collected, I guess. That's how they got it. But they did very well. And you'll notice this from the next verse. It says, Levi gave a big reception for him at his house, and there was a great crowd of tax collectors and other people who were reclining at the table with them. The Pharisees and their scribes began grumbling at his disciples, saying, "Well, I'll get to that in a minute." So Levi was well off enough that he could throw a big party and invite his other tax collector friends. Once again, he has his sins forgiven. He's, you know, got a relationship with Jesus. He wants to share that with the others. Maybe these other, you know, Matthew was the bridge to these other tax collectors. Of course, the Pharisees were critical of this. But later on, if you were a typical Jew, you think, what is he doing calling a tax collector to be one of his disciples, one of the apostles? This guy's a traitor to the cause. He's in bed with the Romans. Who does Jesus think he is? Well, Luke has spent time in chapter 4 and 5 establishing Jesus' authority. Jesus has the authority to choose anybody that he chooses to be the apostles, and he actually chose this Matthew or Levi. And he has authority to do that. So maybe Luke was including this in the context of this chapter just to show Jesus can do this. Doesn't matter what you think about it, what you think about tax collectors in general, Jesus can do this. And he has the authority to do this. So the Pharisees were grumbling, verse 30 says, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered and said to them, this is an interesting answer too, "It's not those who are well that need a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance." Jesus did not defend the tax collectors and say, "Oh, they're not sinners, they're not so bad." He didn't even deal with it. He didn't go there, as we say today. He said, "You know, I've come to preach to the sinners and save and rescue the sinners. You know, if I just hang out with you people who don't need me or don't need God, I'm not doing anything. I got to hang out somewhat with the people who are sinners or I won't be doing my job." So he didn't deny that they were sinners. He just said that's where he belonged. He belonged with them because they're the ones that need him. Just like, you know, when we're sick, we need a doctor. Just finishing up here, in verse 33 it says, and so they started finding ways to criticize him. It sounds to me like already they, for some reason, the investigation has already, the conclusion has already been decided. They're going to report back, this guy is not the Messiah. Whatever their reasons, they're already critical of him. Now, you can understand they need to be skeptical. When they go out to investigate, they need to be somewhat skeptical. They need to get all the facts. But it seems like here we are just in one chapter. We haven't gotten very far. And they've already decided, nah, he isn't it. And now we're just going to pick on him. And eventually they're going to want to kill him. So it doesn't seem like it was a very honest investigation. It didn't take very long. They were already against him. They said, the disciples of John often fast and offer prayers, but the disciples and disciples of the Pharisees do the same. But your disciples, they eat and drink. Now, the Pharisees were known to fast like twice a week. I don't think it was 24 hours, but at least during the day, they fasted twice a week. And Jesus' disciples weren't doing that. And his answer was, you can't make the attendants of the bridegroom fast while the bridegroom's with them. You know, we're still at the wedding feast or whatever. It wasn't really a wedding feast, but you know, when he's there, they're supposed to fast because he's not there. But when the bridegroom is taken away from them, they will fast in those days. And then he gave them a parable. Excuse me. With three examples there. He says, no one tears a piece of cloth from a new garment and puts it on an old garment. Otherwise, he will both tear the new and the piece from the new won't match the old. That's example one. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the new wine will burst the skins and it will be spilled out and the skins will be ruined. Second example. And then the third example. But new wine must be put into fresh wineskins. Oh, I'm sorry. That's part of the second. Third one, verse 39. And no one, after drinking old wine, wishes for new. He says the old is good enough. So what's that all about? Well, you know, Jesus was saying, look, things are different now. It's not the way you think they are. Your interpretation of my Father, your interpretation of his laws, the way you oppress the people, the way you force your will on the people, all this kind of stuff, we're not doing that anymore. That's the wrong approach. And it's just as wrong, it's just as different as putting a new piece of cloth on an old thing to try to fix it, or putting new wine in an old wineskin. It isn't going to work. He says it's a new time. You know, he says it other way places where, you know, the fig trees die. You know, their way of doing things was about ready to be wrapped up. And it's so different that you can't just tweak what you're doing and make it good. We got to start over in a way. And I would have drawn if I had, you remember that, you ever see that thing that where they got like a 3x5 card, they got a little circle, so your comfort zone, and then everything that's outside of that is, what's it say? I don't know what it says, the possible, or I don't know what it says. Huh? Anybody remember? I got one on my, hanging up, and I don't remember what it says. But, I had it hanging up until we cleaned up to sell the house. Now it's not there anymore. But the point is, they were comfortable. They were comfortable in their little circle. And Jesus said, you know, out here is where things are going to happen. And if you stay there, and that's what his point was in the last verse there. He said, nobody wants the new wine. They like the old. They're comfortable with the old wine. You're comfortable in your comfort zone. You're comfortable in your comfort zone. I'm comfortable in my comfort zone. We're all comfortable where we are. And Jesus says, you know, we got to get beyond that. We got to get past that. You got to get out of that comfort zone sometimes in order to get where I'm taking you. And that has implications all throughout the New Testament. I mean, there's all kinds of examples of that, even the Old Testament, where God takes us into places where we really don't want to go. But he does that so we can get out of our comfort zones and learn more about him and trust him instead of trusting our own interpretations about things like the Pharisees did and the Sadducees and the scribes. They had their interpretations about what had happened in the Old Testament, what had happened to Israel, and how we're going to keep this from happening again. And they thought they had it all figured out, and their way was to be ultra conservative, ultra fastidious about every little detail. And that was going to save them. And Jesus said, nah, it's not like that. That's you're in your little comfort zone, but it's not like that. And his point in verse 39 is, you know, it's gotta be different than that. And you gotta try the new wine, but they weren't going to. They were too comfortable where they were. Okay, so Luke, in this whole chapter here, he's establishing Jesus' authority as God's representative, as the Messiah. One way of doing that was to demonstrate his authority to heal and his authority to forgive sins. And as a result of that, he also demonstrates Jesus' authority to choose the apostles from whoever, among whoever he wants, a fisherman or even a tax collector. So what lessons? Got any ideas? At least get some takeaways here. What lessons have we learned from this chapter? Maybe all kinds of them. And there may be lessons that apply to us, maybe just important points. I'll start with one. I think, you know, this chapter makes it clear that Jesus came from his Father, and his power came from his Father. He was human. And verse 17 specifically says that God had empowered him to do this and that. He wasn't doing it because he was some special superhuman. He was a human like you and me that God gave power to do special things. And that's different. Maybe only a subtle difference, but it's different. It's not like in the sense that God was on earth and he knew everything all the time. I don't think Jesus did know everything all the time. He was human like you and me, so we don't know everything. He was limited. In order to experience a human life like we experience a human life, he had to be limited like we are. But God gave him special power to do certain things, even though he was a human. Any other ideas? I got a few here. I got them mostly from the book.
I have a question.
Oh, sure.
In 22, he says he was perceiving their thoughts.
22?
Yeah, verse 22.
It says what?
He was perceiving their thoughts. And I often wonder what that meant. Could he actually perceive their thoughts, or would he just...
There are places where it says that he knew the heart and things like that.
Right.
And there are other places where it says he doesn't know certain things. So I don't have a good answer for that, other than I'll give you my, this is just me sharing my own personal feeling. He had insight. He had maybe unusual insight, but I don't think he could read minds. We can't read minds. But some of us have more insight than others. God has given it, one of the gifts is discernment, right? And discernment of spirits. Jesus had that gift, obviously. Maybe he had all the gifts. You know, we only get one or two or some. We get a few gifts. God, maybe Jesus had them all. I don't believe he could read minds. Because if he could, he wasn't human. Humans can't read minds. That's my personal feeling. But he had insight and discernment. Exceptional discernment, apparently. I'm sure he had discernment. He could read. You know, spirit helping. But I don't think he could read minds. That's just my personal opinion. Because if he did, he wasn't human. I could be wrong, but that's how I look at it. Another example I think we can get from this is, whether it's intentional or unintentional, people can get in our way of getting to Jesus. The paralytic, you know, they tried to get him there, and they had to be real creative in how they got him to Jesus because of the crowd. Sometimes the crowd is trying to keep you from Jesus. Other times maybe it's just a lot of people that are in the way. Were all these people converts? Were all these people believers? Probably not. Some of them were just curious. Maybe they came for the food, you know. Where is that from? Princess Bride? I'm here for one of the, no, Cinderella. One of the Ever After. This came for the food. You know, there were people, Jesus said that. Sometimes they were just coming for the food. Because you got to get through those people. All right? If you really want to get to Jesus, there's going to be people in the way. But we got to get through it. Not that you trample them down. I don't mean that. But we may have to be resourceful to get there, because there'll be people in the way, whether it's intentional or not. And sometimes we might, just like the paralytic, have to rely on friends to help us. That's part of the reason for the body of Christ, right? That we don't have to go it alone. We have community. And sometimes those friends will be there to help us, you know, when we are struggling. God forgives on his terms. You know, we don't need a temple. Don't need animal sacrifices. Jesus forgave them right there. It's interesting also that when the paralytic came for healing, Jesus said, "Your sins are forgiven." So Jesus' business is like he's in the rescue and restoration business, right? It's kind of like he's the guy you call when you have a flood, like your water heater leaks, or you have a fire, you call these restoration companies. The first thing they have to do is rescue, right? They've got to get the water out of the basement, or they got to get the fire smell out, or they got to put the fire out. You know, maybe the fire company comes first, whatever. You've got to rescue first. But then you've got to restore. You've got to get the house back to the condition it's supposed to be in, right? God does the same thing. First, he's got to rescue us. And then he restores us. Okay, so it's both. It's not just one. He needs to restore. Now, we've never been in this restored state. We're going back to like the original creation or something. You know, he wants to make us one with him and one with his son. When we're weak, we need friends. The paralytic needed friends. One other thing, and that is, when these people were healed, they shared the gospel, just like Arlene. Shared the gospel with other people. And we can do that too. God's calling sinners, all right? That's another thing from there. And lastly, to end the chapter, Jesus said, you know, my message is different. I can't blend my message with your interpretation of the scriptures. They don't fit. They don't go together any better than new wine and old wineskins. So we need to be new wineskins. It doesn't mean we throw away everything we believe. I don't mean that, and I don't mean we doubt what we, you know, doubt the truth. That's not my point. But if we don't want to be stuck to our own interpretations of things, of the way things are. We need to let Jesus tell us the way things are and believe it. And let God tell us, and not trust in our own reasoning or our own interpretations. So I think there's a lot of lessons in there, but it seems to me mainly that chapter is a lot about Jesus establishing his authority to do what he was going to do on earth, and Luke stuck it all in the same general area so that we would get that point, that he had a work to do, and he was beginning to do it publicly, and he had the authority to do it, and he realized he was going to be in for a long road. He already had the opposition of the Pharisees and the scribes, and that was going to be true for the rest of the Gospels. And but he was ready for that, and he was teaching something new and different, and we need to be new wineskins in order to absorb that.